This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
The title of my talk today is The Biology of Fatherhood in Humans, Evolutionary Origins and Cross-Cultural Perspectives. So as you can tell from the title of my talk, I'm going to speak quite a bit about the biology of fatherhood in humans, particularly father's hormones. And the starting point for thinking about evolutionary perspectives on human fatherhood and the biology of fatherhood is that human fathers are really unusual in comparison to males in other mammalian species. In the vast majority of mammalian species, mothers are solely responsible for caring for young, and fathers do not cooperate or assist in taking care of those demands. So this is really different from what we commonly see in human fathers in societies across the world. If we compare human fathers to our great ape cousins and really kind of focus in on our closest relatives, what we see is that in the great ape species, fathers do not engage in the intensive, consistent, and costly forms of care that are really common for fathers across a wide range of societies around the world. What this suggests is that the predisposition and the behavioral tendencies for men to invest as fathers is something that likely emerged as a new characteristic in the context of human evolution. Now, humans are not only unusual in the extent to which fathers commonly cooperate with mothers to raise young, but also in the extent to which mothers frequently rely on this broader network of caregivers to assist them with our slow developing, slow growing, very energetically costly offspring. Now, the rise of these kind of more nuanced cooperative caregiving models over the past few decades has allowed us to ask new questions about what fathers were potentially doing in the course of human evolution. There's general consensus that fathers' energetic contributions to family energetic budgets and community energetic budgets through provisioning was likely really important in the course of human evolution. However, I've long been interested in the roles that fathers may have played in the evolutionary past as direct caregivers. Now, the challenge with this is that behaviors like carrying your baby or feeding your baby or playing with children or teaching children do not leave indelible marks in the archaeological record or the fossil record. So this is a challenge for us to think about what lines of evidence might be available to us to kind of think about the importance of these behaviors in the evolutionary past. So what I've argued along with some other colleagues working in this area is that we can look to contemporary human male biology and men's physiological responsiveness to direct caregiving in the transition to fatherhood more generally as an indicator of whether these kinds of behaviors were important in the evolutionary past. The idea behind why we can ask these types of questions about human fathers is grounded in a comparative perspective. We know that biparental care, or care by both parents, has evolved independently in multiple vertebrate lineages. And we also know that we share biological axes and biological systems with these vertebrate species in which biparental care has evolved. And so by looking at the types of signals and biological systems that natural selection has shaped in other species where biparental care has evolved, we can start to ask questions about whether we see similar kind of signals at work in human fathers in contemporary populations. In those other vertebrate species where biparental care has evolved, fathers commonly show a suite of hormonal changes during the periods when they cooperate with mothers to raise young. They often show some combination of lower testosterone, higher oxytocin, and higher prolactin. These shifts in hormones help males kind of adjust their priorities away from competition and mating effort and towards priorities related to parenting effort, particularly cooperating with mothers and being attentive to the needs of their offspring, which can include direct caregiving. In the course of my talk today, I'm going to primarily focus on testosterone, but I will talk a little bit about oxytocin towards the end of my talk. As I kind of try to set the landscape for you in terms of what we know about father's hormones in humans, I'm going to take you back to the early to mid 2000s when people were really first starting to ask these kind of questions about humans. One of my colleagues in anthropology named Peter Gray did a series of foundational studies in the early and mid 2000s comparing men of different life history statuses and looking at their testosterone. So for example, he found that married fathers in the United States often had lower testosterone than men who were single non-fathers. Around the same time, scholars like Ann Story and Allison Fleming were starting to explore whether fathers with different types of hormonal profiles, including lower testosterone, might be more apt to engage in sensitive nurture and care. And in this case, they found that lower testosterone dads were more sensitive to infant cries. So this was starting to lay the groundwork in terms of the types of questions we might ask about fathers' psychobiology in humans. These early studies, while foundational, had some limitations. They tended to be small, and they were cross-sectional, meaning they didn't follow the same men through time. What this means is that they were incapable of addressing directionality between fatherhood and testosterone. Put another way, there was a chicken and an egg problem. Were men with lower testosterone more likely to become fathers, or did the transition to fatherhood precede men's testosterone declining and contribute to that decline? To answer this question, you really need access to a large longitudinal study, and my colleagues and I were able to work on such a study in Cebu City in the Philippines. Cebu City is the second largest city in the Philippines behind Manila and is home to a few million people. The study itself is called the Cebu Longitudinal Health and Nutrition Survey. It's a population representative birth cohort study that was begun in 1983 and 84 when 3,300 pregnant women were enrolled in the study. Their babies that were born in 83 and 84 have been followed at multiple waves of data collection across their lives. And I'm going to talk to you about some of the males who were born into the study with data we collected from them when they were 21 and again when they were age 26. To answer the question about how the transition to partnering and partnered fatherhood might be related to changes in testosterone, you really have to start with a large group of men who haven't gone through either of those transitions, so men who are single non-fathers. We had a group of 465 men who were single non-fathers when they were 21 years old, and we're going to look at how their testosterone changes between ages 21 and 26 based on life history transitions. What we see is that the men who stay single non-fathers between ages 21 and 26 experience really kind of only a modest change in their testosterone. Men who become newly partnered non-fathers experience an intermediate decline in testosterone, around 15% on average. And then the men who become newly partnered new fathers experience a substantial drop in their testosterone on average, 25%, which again, these are men in their mid-20s. So this is a very large and biologically meaningful change in testosterone for men who are in their reproductive primes. If we look at this based on how old men's youngest children were, we see that men who had newborns at home experience an even larger decline in testosterone on average, up to 42%. And if we scale this out based on how old men's youngest children were, what we see is it follows kind of a J-shaped curve where men's testosterone is lowest when they have a young infant, and then it starts to creep back up closer to where it was before they became a partnered father, but never quite getting to that point. If we think about this from an evolutionary perspective, it might be beneficial to downregulate testosterone when your partner's needs and your infant's needs are at their peak, but then start to ramp that production back up as you're kind of moving to a stage where you might be thinking about having another child or you might be pursuing other mating opportunities. The other question we wanted to ask is whether we saw any links between these testosterone dynamics and men's roles in families. So we first asked whether testosterone was lower among men who were more involved in childcare. And what we saw is that men who reported being the most involved with childcare or spending the most time in proximity to their kids had significantly lower testosterone than men who reported not being involved with that kind of caregiving. Next, we looked at whether men's testosterone was lower when they were sharing a sleeping service, so co-sleeping, with their partners and their young children. And we found that men who share a sleeping service with their partners had substantially lower testosterone than men whose babies were sleeping elsewhere in a separate room. And this is actually independent of what they're doing during the day. So we're seeing this link between father's behavior, both during the day and at nighttime, and their testosterone profiles. Now, there's a couple of different ways to think about this. One is that the transition to fatherhood might contribute to a decline in testosterone, and that lower testosterone then might help facilitate or motivate some men to be involved in childcare. Other longitudinal studies that have come out since our work have shown findings that are consistent with this, including work in the United States from Robin Edelstein and colleagues tracking men's testosterone through the pregnancy of their partners and finding that if men's testosterone goes down more during their partner's pregnancy, they're then more involved with helping to take care of their infant. Their partners are more satisfied and their partners feel that they're more committed. And then in work we did, led by a former member of my lab, Dr. Patty Kuo, we found that if men's testosterone was lower in the days right around when their babies were born, they were substantially more involved with childcare in a range of forms a few months later. So again, both of these studies are consistent with the idea that declines in testosterone in dads might be kind of leading the way in terms of their involvement and commitment to family life. Another possibility is that for some men, they transition to fatherhood and they're very motivated to be involved with childcare. And that involvement in childcare actually contributes to their testosterone then going down. What I've long argued is that this is likely a feedback loop where men's lower testosterone can help facilitate their involvement in childcare, but then that involvement in childcare contributes to kind of the maintenance of that lower testosterone in this kind of feedback loop. We were able to start to explore this with our longitudinal data in the Philippines by looking at young fathers in Cebu and looking at how their change in testosterone mapped onto their change in childcare behavior through time. So we're looking at within individual changes in both of those domains. And what we found is that if fathers increased their involvement in childcare through time, then their testosterone went down. And if they decreased their involvement in childcare through time, their testosterone went back up. So we're seeing these two things move in tandem. This set of findings linking father's lower testosterone to more involvement in childcare and particularly sensitive nurturing forms of childcare has been found in a variety of different cultural contexts around the world. I'm going to talk to you specifically about a study that was led by Martin Muller and colleagues in 2009 that was really foundational to some of the work that my colleagues have and I have been doing since then in the Republic of the Congo. In this really foundational study, Martin Muller and colleagues studied two subsistence societies that lived side by side in the same environment in Tanzania. Among Gatoga pastoralists, fathers are very committed to their families, but they don't spend time taking care of kids, and they really don't spend very much time with infants or young children at all. And in that society, fathers and non-fathers look almost identical in terms of their testosterone values. Now, in their neighboring Hadza foragers, where fathers are involved with childcare, they spend a lot of time with children in camp, and they often co-sleep with their families, fathers had significantly lower testosterone than non-fathers. So this was one of the first hints that kind of cultural models of family life and how fathers were expected to interact with their children and their families might shape what these biological profiles related to fatherhood would look like. Building from this, my colleagues and I started a study in Republic of the Congo that was really focused on cultural differences in fathering and physiology and how those differences in fathering and father's biological profiles were linked to children's health in these respective cultural groups. Our study focuses on two neighboring subsistence societies living in a remote region of the rainforest in the Congo Basin. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the two cultural groups in some subsequent slides, but they both subsist off of the rainforest and kind of the immediate resources in the environment in different ways. The Banongo fisher farmers are members of a smaller scale society. There's only around 200 people from their cultural group that live in this village. They engage in slash and burn agriculture and fishing. They have a very rigid social hierarchy based on gender, age, and acquired status. And in this society, fathers are valued as providers of resources and also moral and social educators of children. And one of the things that's important in terms of thinking about what the biology of fatherhood might look like in this context is that the things that men do to acquire resources and status for their family are often risky and involve them kind of competing with other males for status in that hierarchical community. In addition to kind of those components of fatherhood, our participants often emphasize that really high quality, good dads also avoided verbal and physical conflict with their wives. Now, among the Bayaka foragers, again, similarly living in a smaller scale society context, they are strongly egalitarian and they engage in extensive resource sharing and cooperation. They subsist via foraging, so they hunt and they fish and they collect resources from the rainforest. And in this society, fathers are also valued as providers of resources, but also as teachers of children and as community sharers. So because resources are shared very widely, part of the model of what makes a good father in this cultural group is not only providing resources to your own immediate family, but acquiring those resources and then sharing them outward into the community. Similar to the Bandongo, Bayaka adults also emphasize that good dads avoid verbal and physical conflict with their spouses. So because these are small scale societies and they're small communities and the fathers know each other really well, typically they've known each other for most of their lives. What we did is we had fathers rank one another in terms of the quality of care they provided in these different domains. So I'm going to show you two specific results today for how men were ranked as it related to being good providers and how they were ranked in terms of having conflict with their wives, which we call dispute. First, what we see is that among the Bandongo fisher farmers, the dads who are ranked as better providers have higher testosterone than dads who are ranked as lower quality providers. So the highest quality dads in this important domain, in this challenging environment, actually have higher testosterone, not lower testosterone. And again, we think this may have to do with the fact that the way that they provide resources interrelates with how they acquire status, how they compete with other males, and that some of these behaviors are quite risky. Among the Bandongo, we not only have testosterone data, but we also have oxytocin data. And when we look at how testosterone and oxytocin kind of take shape within individuals based on how they're ranked as a provider, what we see is that dads who are ranked as better providers have higher testosterone and lower oxytocin. So again, the highest quality dads in this setting, higher testosterone, lower oxytocin. This is not what we commonly see in settings like the United States and Europe in terms of how kind of the biological profiles of high quality fathering play out in terms of these hormones. Now, when we look at conflict between spouses, the men who are rated as having more conflict with their partners also have higher testosterone and lower oxytocin. So the men who have less conflict with their partners have higher oxytocin and lower testosterone. And this is actually similar to what you would see in contexts like the United States. What we know about children's health and well-being in this context is that children whose dads are ranked as better providers show better indicators of child growth. So if their dads are better at acquiring resources from the environment, it seems that they're kind of getting better nutrition and growing in a more healthy way. But we also see that in families where there's more conflict, children have higher indicators of physiological stress, which we looked at through immune system markers and epigenetic profiles. And so what this suggests, it gives us some indication of how kind of different biological profiles for fathers can be maintained and be beneficial in different ways within the same societal context. Now, again, kind of returning to the Bayaka foragers, where the model of what makes a good father and what family life looks like is different. When we look at relationships between fathers' rankings and testosterone in this side setting, what we see is that fathers who are ranked as better sharers of resources have substantially lower testosterone on average than men who are ranked as less generous sharers. And then when we look at providing, what we see is the opposite of what I just showed you for the Bandongo. Men who are ranked as better providers among the Bayaka tend to have lower testosterone than men who are ranked as lower quality providers. So again, kind of the opposite profile, despite the behavior being very similar, we see an opposite profile among the Bayaka dads compared to the Bandongo dads, which likely has a lot to do with aspects of their kind of respective cultural systems. Now, when we look we combine data in both societies, what we see is that in families where there's less marital conflict, Dads have lower testosterone. And when families in both cultural settings have higher conflict, the dads have higher T. So despite these kind of differences culturally in family life, we do see these commonalities in the way that testosterone is related to marital conflict. And we know that this also maps on to what we see in settings like cultural contexts, like in societies in Europe and in the United States. If we think about how fathering profiles are related to children's health and well-being among the Bayaka, what we see is that when dads are rated as being higher quality in these culturally valued domains, children similarly show kind of lower indications of physiological stress. But we don't see links between Bayaka fathers' provisioning roles or their sharing of resource roles and children's growth profiles. This is probably because the Bayaka share resources so widely that the variation in whether your father is a good provider or not is buffered by the broader kind of community sharing of resources and the community cooperative approach to caring for young. So the main take-home points from my talk are that humans have an evolved but flexible neuroendocrine architecture that's related to multiple modes of fatherhood. As we'd expect, it helps to focus behavioral priorities, but the way that that takes form is different based on context. If we think about what this might tell us about understanding human origins more broadly, I think it helps us to rethink the potential roles for fathers as cooperative caregivers. There's strong evidence, and we kind of generally agree, that human life history was facilitated by cooperative caregiving. Fathers have kind of largely been pigeonholed into solely being providers in the context of that narrative about human evolution. And I think this work suggests that we need to think more broadly about what fathers may have been doing in the evolutionary past, which also helps us think about what fathers are capable of in contemporary societies where fathers play all sorts of diverse roles. The additional way that I think this helps us think about human origins is that committed fathering can be seen as a factor that helps integrate males into pro-social generous community networks. Like I said, cooperative caregiving is thought to have been really foundational to the evolutionary success of our species. But more broadly, we know that humans have kind of made a turn towards pro-social, generous, cooperative behavior, even outside of caregiving, that allows our societies to be successful and to thrive. And I think this points to a role for committed fatherhood and some of these biological changes that come along with it in potentially helping to facilitate men's integration into those community networks in the course of human evolution. Thank you for your time.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.